Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm your co-host, Jeannie Rice. We also have Dr. Tim Hayes with us, and we welcome you to the show. Today is, what is today? Today is Thursday, May the 14th, 2015. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us, and we would love to hear your comments and your questions because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart. We welcome everybody. We're honored, delighted that you choose to join us every day that you choose to join us. And as we move forward in our understanding of how this mind and this world around us and within us works, it's powerful to have some deeper understanding of that whole process. It's interesting that most people come into the world and the most important device they'll ever engage with technology that is beyond comprehension, even to the supercomputers we have today, their own minds, they're given little or no training on how to use it. Someone else stuffs it full of information, and whatever else they choose to stuff it with, or I guess it would probably be more decide to stuff it with, the insanity, the hostilities, the fears, as I said yesterday in the movie, the water diviner, this gentleman finally understands that he's the one who set his children up to be end up being killed in war because he's the one who programmed them for the mindset of fight and strife. And so when we understand how this device works and we realize that we have been hoodwinked, we've been brainwashed with ideas that don't have anything to do with the truth about life. They have to do with what a lot of other people want from us, and that, sadly, is usually based in grief. But when you start to really understand how this thing works and you have some instruction, you know, most people drive their minds like they would drive a car with no instruction. You know, somebody who has no idea how to drive a car gets up on the dash of the car, reaches for the steering wheel, has a stick to hit the gas pedal, looks out the back window and drives and wonders why there are all kinds of accidents. People who have no idea how to drive or control or be in charge of their own minds, wonder why they're always bumping into things and creating drama and trauma in their lives, destroyed relationships, destroyed finances, destroyed businesses, et cetera, et cetera. And so as we start to understand more and more about it, and we actually choose to take the time to get some training. You know, it's interesting. Someone who wants to be a computer technician will go to school for 4 years full time. And then they'll study for the rest of their lives just to understand how a silly computer works. And 20, 30 years later, you take your computer to this technician and they say, well, you know, I don't know for sure. I'll have to see if I can figure that out. And most people, when it comes to their minds, the most important piece of technology they'll ever interact with, say, I've got $5 in 5 minutes, tell me everything you know, and no, I'm not going to invest time, and no, I'm not going to face what's already been put in there, and no, I'm not going to clean it up. I'm just, you know, this is the way I am. I remember working with a gentleman in South Florida, a medical doctor of mine who used this work in his practice, sent one of his patients who had cancer to me. And we got down to the point where this man realized why he had cancer, what the energy was with which he created cancer. And he decided that he'd just as soon die as get rid of it, because in his mind, and this is, you know, not understanding how the technology works, in his mind, that was just a part of who he was, and without that, he wouldn't be the same person. It's like, well, that's true. You wouldn't be the same person, but do you really want to be this person that has energetic dynamics that create cancer? It's like, no, I'm sticking to my story. And he died of cancer. Pretty crazy. But I just put a Facebook post up this morning, found an interesting interview with the gentleman who heads up Brain Games. And apparently Brain Games now is the most popular television production ever on National Geographic. And they're just doing some great stuff with the brain, and they're starting to get to understanding how the thing works. One of the things that he talks about in this interview, and if you want to look it up on our website, or pardon me, on Facebook, my Facebook page is JM_RYCE. Send us a friend request, but you can go on there and give a listen to this interview. He's on one of the ABC or NBC somewhere. But he talks about how, you know, everybody thinks that the mind is seeing what's out there, and he talks about the fact that it's a construct. It's pretty cool. And then what was really interesting, and I put another post on because I went from there to Stanford's site, he quotes some research from Stanford on states of awe and how people, when they go into awe, their whole perception of time changes. And they become more compassionate, they become more joyful, and they get healthier. And in looking at what they're calling the state of awe, we're looking at something that overwhelms the mind to the point where the mind can't function anymore. And, of course, you've heard me many times say, in order to truly heal, in order to truly incarnate as a human being, you've got to be out of your mind. And so this state of awe, as I was reading about it from the Stanford research, which has all these health benefits and psychological benefits and helps people to be more compassionate, is exactly what happens with first century Aramaic forgiveness. How did this guy 2,000 years ago develop the technology to show people how to be out of their minds, to collapse what the mind is currently preoccupied with its current hallucination, its current construct, to allow a bigger piece of the puzzle in? And so, pardon me, some pretty cool technology there that's starting to open the gates to approach what the scriptures wrote about 2,000 years ago. And when you can decode it properly from the Aramaic, the understanding is beyond comprehension. And science is just starting to scratch the surface. So it's pretty cool. You might want to check those posts out. They're really interesting. And Brain Games gives you all kinds of things to look into how your mind works and to sharpen your senses. And he stopped just short of the idea that we've come up with, and maybe they'll bring this forward, or maybe we'll communicate with them at some point and offer them some forgiveness technology. But he stopped short of saying the world you see is painted on the inside of your eyeballs. But in essence, that was the bottom line. Is that everything you see, you have no windows to look out onto the world. Everything that you see is a construct in your mind. And if it's based in pain, fear, hostility, rage, guilt, grief, or trauma, which, sadly, most of the experiences of most people in the world today are based in that, then life becomes a pretty tough game locked into that construct. But forgiveness, the same as with awe, causes those constructs to collapse. You can't have an awestruck moment unless something doesn't fit into your mind and your mind has to quit. It has to stop its regular game in order for you to take in this awesome experience, which is what Stanford did research on. And in precisely the same way, on a continuous, consistent, persistent basis, if you apply the tool of first century Aramaic forgiveness, you'll have exactly the same experience. Your mind will collapse its construct, and when collapsing its construct, taking a little bigger picture of who you are. And with that comes things like compassion, better health, more psychological soundness, just all kinds of cool things. So it's nice to see the world of science starting to catch up with what they understood 2,000 years ago. And I think because it was understood and taught 2,000 years ago, and it didn't serve kings to have people who functioned as real human beings, as love. You know, if you hold a newborn child, you know exactly what a human being is. It doesn't serve kings to have people doing that because, you know, it's hard to get them to go, you know, do war and steal other people's property and, you know, things like that. It's tough to do. So this understanding has been turned into, and it's the most skillful thing to have deteriorated what Yeshua taught 2,000 years ago in the Aramaic to what many will say, well, you know, I live in the secular world. I don't have anything to do with that silly book that they wrote 2,000 years ago out of ignorance. It was actually somebody who had a post on Facebook this morning, and they were talking about this silly book, and this was a so-called scientist, this silly book that's based in ignorant, non-knowing minds. It's like, sir, if you knew how far ahead these people were compared to what you and I are today, you wouldn't believe it. But the problem is, you know, if you've ever heard the term lost in translation, the Aramaic nuances and subtle understandings that are just being uncovered now were totally lost to the Greeks. You know, if Yeshua sat in most places today where they were teaching the Greek ideas that have been taught as his thoughts, he would say, that's all Greek to me, and that would be the end of the conversation, because there's just very little relationship between what he actually taught and what the Greeks tell us about. And so delving into the Aramaic technology, the Aramaic understanding, we see such a comprehension of how the world works, how your body works, how your mind works, how to incarnate more and more of the truth of who you are. It's just amazing. And so it's a delight to have each of you on this journey with us, moving forward into, you know, the pinnacle of this process is that of actually getting to incarnate. I think it's called fulfilling our original purpose, and that is to incarnate as the created spiritual beings that we are, as this awesome presence of love, and in so doing, honoring the presence of love in the world and being guided by it, functioning out of it. And, you know, the word in Aramaic for that was called worship. That when I emulate and honor the presence of love, which if you listen to the ancient Aramaic, the creator is love, then I get to experience worship. And that opens a whole other space where I get to keep bringing in deeper and deeper and deeper levels and layers. And I have no idea how far it goes. I just know that in 45 years of working with it and watching thousands of other people work with it, it seems to be an endless journey. What is there to incarnate? You know, if you go back to the ancient teachings, they said the mind of man is not yet conceived of what lies in store. You know, what's in the storehouse? What's waiting for us to discover? What are we potentially moving toward? And if you look at what the ancient teachers were able to embody, they said, the things I do, you can do in greater. So that's what we're working toward, is really, truly living in that space we were designed to, instead of being the slaves of kings. And the provincial secular mind that has no clue of what was actually taught there throws it out because it's been made to sound like some sort of hogwash. But, oh, it is so powerful when you start to actually use it. And that's the trick. It's using it, understanding how to put it into action is the real key. And so one of the things that we've got going on that's new, and we'll announce it again, is that on the website, if you go to whyagain.org, you'll see a bullseye in the middle of the page, whyagain.org, bullseye in the middle of the page. Click on that, and a series of links will open. That will begin to unfold and give you the Aramaic forgiveness process. If you go to either the second or the third link at the very top of the page, you'll see a link to a PowerPoint that we thank you, Bill Costantino, for putting that together. Just awesome skills at doing that. And so you'll see a link to a PowerPoint, and it'll take 35 years of learning and put it into 24 minutes, and you'll get to see how the whole forgiveness process works, how it unfolds, and how to do it. And aside from that, on that third link, you'll see at least 14 different radio shows where either Dr. Tim or Jeannie or myself walk somebody through the whole forgiveness process from start to finish. So you've got instructions on how to use the worksheet. That PowerPoint presentation will take you through the toughest piece of it, the core, where in the Aramaic the word forgive is shebag, and it means to cancel. And the silliest thing on earth for the secular mind would be, but I have this perfectly logical, reasonable goal that I want to fulfill, and the only reason I'm enraged is because Charlie's stopping me from fulfilling it. Then, you know, this person looks outside themselves as though the problem is with Charlie, instead of looking inside themselves. And the way you look inside yourself is to take that goal from that very wonderful thing that you want, cancel that goal, and that collapses the projection that it's got anything to do with Charlie, and you get to see the part of your mind that holds rage. And when you bring awe, when you bring the presence of love to the part of your mind that holds rage, guess what happens? Your rage starts to disappear, and you get to the point where you're just not capable of rage anymore. It's just not there anymore. So it's a pretty fabulous process, and we're delighted and honored that each of you joins with us and shares with us this this journey. It's certainly an exciting one. Dr. Tim, how do you be today, young man?
I'm doing quite well, thank you. I would like to add to what you just said.
Yes.
Here's a testimonial
please.
from a therapist who has no exposure to Dr. Rice's work, has never been to one of my mind shifter groups, but one of the people who has had exposure to the video gave the video to her therapist and said, look into this. And the therapist wrote, thank you for sharing this phenomenal video with me. And then the word wow in all caps, followed by ellipsis, dot, dot, dot. What a gift of a resource for those who understand and are moved to explore the intersection of their spiritual selves and human experience. She writes, I am a slow processor and would view it again a couple more times to take it all in. Though because of my work as a therapist and exposure to this process through you, the person who gave her the video, I generally grasped all the concepts and the process as I watched. It may be the schema book that I recommended to you that speaks to the piece of how limited our perception and our personal realities are, referred to in the video as the 9-bit mind. So here's a therapist with no exposure to the work, saw it the first time and said, wow, what a phenomenal resource. So, high praise, and everyone I've shared it with asked if they could get the link to watch it again. So take advantage of that. Thanks again to Michael, Jeannie, Bill for your efforts. This is a wonderful resource. And, of course, it doesn't do the work for you, but it might make your conscious mind understand the process more so that you can actually pick up the tool and engage it. Engaging the tools is what creates the big shifts. And I'm just glad to be on the team. I'm very, very glad to have that resource.
Well, so am I. And, you know, our only desire, well, I won't say our only, I have lots of others too, but our primary desire is to put that into the hands of every mind, heart, and being on the planet. You know, if you listen to, and the words you put in cap, wow, that's one of those awe experiences, and it's really cool to look at this Stanford research on what awe does to us. And so it is truly an awe-inspiring technology. I personally feel sometimes or think in terms of, you know, what did I ever do to deserve to get to do this, to actually help to uncover the core of what Yeshua's actually teaching people how to do to heal themselves. Well, you know, like, it doesn't get any better than this. How cool is it? And so whatever we can do to put it into more and more hands, we are doing moment by moment by moment, and it's pretty fabulous to people who get on the team like yourself, Tim, like Michelle, like Rex, like feel, and just watching how it all comes together and spreads out from the place of beginning, diffusion, into the culture.
Agreed.
Yeah, you'll have to send me a copy of that, of the statement from your psychologist friend, or the person you're, is this someone that has a practice there locally?
Somewhat locally. I'm not exactly sure where her office is, and she's a therapist of some kind. I don't know that, but I will send this in an email to you now while I'm thinking about it, since I'm here at my computer.
Awesome. Very cool. Very cool. Well, anything else on your mind before we check the phone lines?
I feel complete.
Okay, well, we're still in High Springs, Florida. Pretty day, probably about 85 degrees and sunny. And we'll be starting probably shortly after the show to do a little bit of packing up. And tomorrow evening we'll be on the road heading toward Atlanta. We'll get partway to Atlanta and spend the night. And then on Sunday morning, we'll be doing an 11 a.m. Sunday service at Unity in Marietta, Georgia. Kind of one of my original speaking places was in Marietta, and I'm hoping, and as I understand it, the original minister, who was a very close friend in Atlanta many years ago, is going to be there. It just happens to be that we're coming in to do their home. We're going to keynote at their homecoming week. So that would be pretty cool. It's a pretty large church with in a place I've spoken, I don't know, probably 30 or 40 times over the last several decades. And so it'll be fun to be back there. So anybody that's in the Marietta, Georgia area, Atlanta, you know, Macon, anywhere in that circle, come and join us Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then all day Saturday, Mind Shifters and Soul Point Breathing. We'll be delighted to get to share the tools with you. Of course, Sunday through Friday are all free open workshops. There is a fee on the Saturday workshop. It's an all-day workshop that will start at 8 in the morning, go through till sometime between 5 and 6 in the evening. When you get into doing process work, if people don't have an investment, it's pretty easy for them to turn tail and find somebody to blame and run. So we're going to be doing that workshop a week from Saturday. And if anybody wants to join us, you can just go to the website and drop us a note, register, and we'll look forward to seeing you. And other than that, Jeannie, do we have anybody in the chat room with anything exciting that we need to be aware of, or anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Jeannie tells me that area code 618 is on the line. So 618, give us a name. Where are you calling from?
Hey, Michael. This is Gail.
Oh, hey there, young lady. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for
Gail
calling
Gail is one
me
of our very newest teachers. She just did a 20-day teacher training in Orlando, and she's back in St. Louis. And so we'll be excited to see what develops there. Gail, what's exciting in your world?
I feel like a different person. And things feel very weird right now, and I wanted to thank you for calling me this morning and encourage me to call into the show and ask my questions today. So thank you for that. What I guess I should say is that when I did the first personal code evaluation before we started the teacher training down in Kissimmee, I had three scores that were in crisis, and after the last score or after the last evaluation that I took, all my scores are now in the top third. So I increased my scores, but most of them, well, some of them by like 50 points or more, and that I understand is quite a change. And I was wondering if you've experienced other people that have made that dramatic change and then have gone home and have hit like a lull or have felt weird because of so many changes that they've made, and if you have any suggestions on what to do to ease that a little bit.
Absolutely. So. Well, if you remember the last scale on the list was consistency or validity, and we caution that when you make such huge changes as you made, you know, as you say, 50, 60-point changes in several different areas, when you make that kind of a leap, the old mind still hangs around. And, you know, my experience is the old mind's kind of back there, sort of, if you could imagine it as the non-being self, it's sort of wringing its hands saying, oh, won't you please come home, Bill Bailey? Come on back. You know, I want you to be in my drama and trauma world, and here you are. You're not picking and down on yourself. You've now got an 89 on your love of self. What's wrong with you? Come back to me with that 33. Let's do a little self-hate. Let's do a little fear. Let's do a little trepidation. And so the old mind is definitely in the conversation. And then when you realize that feelings are a shadow of content of the mind, you in that 20 days unloaded so much content that going back home and expecting those old feelings, it's going to feel weird. Because you removed so much that you're not going to be capable of feeling. So it doesn't feel normal anymore. And it'll take a bit of time to get to where this new level of being able to be the presence of love for yourself rather than a destructive conversation, being able to be the presence of love for someone else rather than being a critical conversation, being able to love truth and see things that yesterday you didn't see, having let go of such deep-level fears and hostilities, and having the will, the strengthened will to be able to move forward in your process, all of that is such a dramatic change. And it's changes that, as far as, you know, the normal world goes, you can't make. And you've made them. So is it going to feel strange as you adapt to literally a whole new set of content in your mind from what you had? Yeah, it's going to be a change. That's why we did that closure lesson on the spiritual journey and mentioned that idea. In fact, the quote from that piece that we read at the end is, it is a strange journey walking alone. And, you know, the old haunts that used to be fulfilling because it resonated information and energy within you aren't going to feel the same anymore because that stuff's just not there anymore. And so there'll be places that you go that, you know, yesterday were filled with feeling, not necessarily of the highest caliber, that those feelings just aren't going to be there. I remember back about, oh, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I got a letter from a young woman who came to Heartland the first year that we opened. I put a call out, invited people who'd been to our intensives, if you'd like to come be on our team, then come and do that. And so this gal was a grade 9 student. She had done one intensive, and she decided to quit school and she was going to come to Heartland. Her parents were rather agitated and pointed their agitation toward me. I said, wait a minute. This is between you and your daughter. Your daughter has a really strong inclination to do this, and I'm not going to block her. If you feel like that's not appropriate for her, please stop her. But take me out of the loop. I've just opened a space, and she feels like it's her work to do. Well, she spent 3 years at Heartland. When this gal, she was from inner city Dayton, Ohio. Literally, their food program was Coke and McDonald's for dinner. That's how they ate. And she shared with the group when she first got to Heartland that she had never eaten a carrot in her life. And this girl's like, great. 9 students. So she's what? 17, 16, whatever. She spent 3 years at Heartland, ended up going off to college as a mature student and getting a degree and marrying actually the dean of the school, and they created a very successful business and did very well. And she wrote me about 10 years ago and she said, Michael, I want to thank you for the fact that I have a life. She said, for the first time since I was at Heartland, I just recently went back home to visit some of my friends. Now, these are her, you know, grade 8, grade 9 childhood friends who were, you know, when they were kids, they're Coke and M&M kind of kids and McDonald's, and that's what they eat and smoke and all of that. She said, when I went back, she said, you know, it never occurred to me that everybody else didn't do something similar to what I did. It was like, you know, I'm now a gourmet vegetarian chef. She said, I grow my own organic garden. I'm familiar with every kind of vegetable and fruit you can eat, and I create awesome food for myself and my husband, and I grow it too. And she said, I went back there, and these guys are still going to McDonald's and buying their food. These guys are still drinking Coke by the liters. So like, I haven't touched a Coke since I was at Heartland 10 years ago. And so was it strange for her, even after 10 years, you know, that she'd been away from these friends, 10 or 12 years, was it strange for her to go back and be in that old environment and just not have any resonance with it anymore? It was strange. But she was really delighted that she had a life. So it is a strange feeling when you start moving to those new levels. And, of course, continue to do your work. One worksheet at a time, step by step, consistent, persistent work, and all of the old haunting from the old mind will totally evaporate from your structure.
Gotcha. I've continued to juice. One of the things that Jeannie said, if you don't have access to a juicer, to do the Bolt House juices. So I've continued to do that. I haven't had any
awesome.
Milk for a month. Which is huge for me to not have milk. I haven't had that in a month. I've upped my worksheets up to 10 a day instead of 5.
All right.
And I've still pointed myself to sleep almost every night since I've been home. I missed last night because I fell asleep before I had a chance to, but I went ahead and did some still point this morning. So those are the things that I continue to do, and I'm going to start tackling the challenge sheet that we had after our personal code evaluations and stuff.
Right,
so
right.
Continue doing that as well.
Beautiful, beautiful. Right on track. Well, you're in for lots of fun rides as you move through the next layer and as you move your personal work forward and as you share it with others. It'll be wonderful if you'll keep us posted and keep in touch with us with all that.
Well, thank you for the validation, and thank you for calling me again this morning, and it's been a pleasure being on the show again.
All right, delighted. We'll look forward to seeing you.
Great. Fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. Lots of love and blessings. Take care. Bye-bye. 646-200-4169 is our calling number, and it's always exciting to watch people pick up the tools, put them to work, and make the kind of changes that can't be made. Dr. Tim, maybe you'd share with us just a couple of thoughts about the first time you looked at the personal code evaluation and heard that people were getting 50, 60, 70-point shifts on a 100-point scale on that. Want to share that with us?
Well, you must be referring to how when I was in graduate school, I was trained with the scientific knowledge, and I put that in quotes, scientific knowledge in quotes, that certain personality traits were just fixed in a person by the time they were of a certain age, usually, you know, grade school, late grade school age. And these were things that you could reliably test and then know they were going to stay at that level for the person's life unless a dramatic event or years and years of intensive therapy, and then they might budge a little and they might, you know, learn to cope with these traits, but the traits couldn't change. And the basis of those traits was built into, or the measurement for those traits were said to be very highly reliable over time. So things like the Myers-Briggs personality trait and the 16PF and the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, these things were said to be very highly accurate and valid, not so necessarily highly accurate, but very valid and accurate pictures of a person and the fundamental traits of a person that by the time they were an adult were just going to be that way. And unless you had years and years of therapy or some dramatic life crisis, it wasn't going to change. And by the time I came to Heartland the first time, I had already been using the tools and knew it. It made big changes in me, and I knew that the potential for change. It was still startling for me to see the level and degree of change in people who went to an intensive, and they took this reliable assessment device before and after. So that it's just, you know, take into consideration the fact that prior to 2004, those who were in my field of psychology and psychiatry, the vast majority of them, not all of them, but the vast majority of them, that said they were relying upon science, were operating under the belief that whenever I had an experience that was recorded in my mind and was going to be there for my lifetime, and that the negative experiences and the traumatic experiences couldn't be undone or unwritten, and the primary focus of therapies was to create coping tools for that and to create, with, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, help people mentally rehearse something more positive that they could tap into when the old negative stuff got resonated. And it wasn't until 2004 that they had solid evidence through neuroimaging and neurology techniques where they actually demonstrated the rewriting of neural pathways. And in combination with the idea of neuroplasticity, which is the ability for the brain's neurons to change, to adapt their functioning, to pick up the functioning of other neural pathways that have been damaged, and to make new connections in the brain, where they actually saw the dismantling of the neural structure that held the negative content, the traumatic content, the negative emotional charge, that they began to admit. And it's still, you know, some people who don't want to admit it, but they've got the neurological imaging techniques that demonstrate. And this is only 2004, so we're 10, 11 years from actual scientific proof, overturning what was taught to me in graduate school, in undergrad and graduate school, about the way the mind and body works. So rather than read a bunch of studies, I strongly encourage people, pick up the tool and try it. Because even if the book you're reading says it can't be done, if you pick up the tool and it works, go with what works.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things you triggered when you spoke about the neural pathways and such is, you know, an absolutely amazing word for me from the ancient Aramaic that was translated by the Greeks as blessed are they. When you go back to the Aramaic, that it says something much closer to the fact that in us there is a latent neural structure that was implanted by the Creator to guide us to happiness and well-being. And there was technology for making that the underlying energy of the output of your mind, that the technology of forgiveness would empower people to move to the point where, instead of hostility and fear being at the root of their perceptual mind and the constructs their mind creates, that love would be at the root of their perception and the constructs their minds create. And, you know, I mean, to recognize that 2,000 years ago, and I have people say, oh, come on now, they knew about neural structures back then? Yeah, they absolutely did. And the whole dynamic of the conscious and the unconscious mind are laid out in the ancient Aramaic, right in the syntax of the language. And that, because of, I think, the manipulations and the machinations of men, who really didn't want people to be that empowered, very cleverly it was disguised and destroyed when it was turned into Greek. And now love is something about what you do to your brother or to somebody else instead of a state of being. Forgiveness is something you do to let somebody else off the hook instead of change the neural structures in your own mind. I mean, we could go on and on. In fact, Dale and I are going to have the fun opportunity on Tuesday and Wednesday night of doing Aramaicisms. So at Unity in Marietta, Dale and I are going to take 2 hours each evening, and we're going to create a new set of DVDs for Aramaicisms, and we're going to look at a number of those different Aramaic words and ideas and basic concepts for understanding what's at the root of the mind and what was really taught in Aramaic for how to incarnate and embody in a mind that had at its root the presence of love. It's like, it's so simple and so powerful and so straightforward, but has been lost in the complexity of all of the hostilities and fears of the world. So we're looking forward to an exciting couple of nights with Dale next week. And we'll have to see if we can find out a way to make you a fly on the wall for that, Jim.
That would be lovely. So,
okay,
so
we'll work on
that. Does that mean that Dale and his wife have fully recovered from their food poisoning adventure?
Yes, they're back up and running. All things moving forward. I've been talking to Dale over the last couple of days.
Great.
So they live in Asheville, so they're about 3 hours away, and so they're going to come down for Tuesday and Wednesday and do the Aramaicisms with me. So that'll be a cool couple of evenings. So, Jeannie, do we have anybody with a hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room to be aware of?
Well, we don't have anybody with their hand up, and nobody's in the chat room with a question. However, I did get an email from someone yesterday, and they said that if we had time, if we could address this, it said in 5B on the worksheet that they could not pinpoint an exact traumatic memory for a trigger, and could they still heal from the trigger? They're doing worksheets on their preschool daughter obeying them. She says, I sat with 5B for a while and got that it was ancestral. Do I still need to figure out exactly the memory at this point, or can I just be aware that there's something that happened in the past and still invite love in?
I would say absolutely. Keep inviting the love in, and cognitive awareness, although it can be an interesting and powerful step, isn't the most important step. The most important step is opening the part of the mind that's been dissociated from, that holds that pain or trauma and turmoil, and bringing the presence of love, which I think would be, in the context of our earlier conversation, would be much like awe, bringing that presence of love into that part of the mind, and it creates the transformations necessary. If there's something, my experience is that there's something for us to be cognitively aware of, then tomorrow or next week or maybe 6 months from now, I'll be doing a worksheet or I'll be walking down the street and all of a sudden, bingo, this whole insight comes to mind, this whole awareness of something that I didn't know about. But, you know, it's kind of like in order to empty the garbage can, do I have to open the garbage bag and take out the old eggshells? Do I have to take the milk carton in hand and throw it away? Do I need to get into the mushy leftover stuff that was in the back of the fridge that got kind of hairy from being there for too long? Do I have to pick that up and throw it out? No, I can throw the whole bag out. And then if cognitive awareness is necessary, it will come in its appropriate time. But more important, what we're looking to do is, again, be out of your mind. Like, cognitive awareness is not all it's cracked up to be. Expose the parts of the mind that are based in hostility and fear to the active presence of love, and cognition's irrelevant. Those energetic dynamics in ourselves are going to change, and the whole idea of this work is to get into the energetic space of a human being, to carry with you this awesome active presence of love, and then anything that comes up in your mind. You know, if you go back to Yeshua, they say to him, what's the first law? And we've talked about this the last couple of days. He says, Rachma. He didn't say, have cognitive awareness of what went wrong in your childhood. Not what it's about. It's about having these filters that we talked about yesterday and the day before active, Rachma and Kubba, and then if life resonates something painful from inside of you, by the commitment and the practice of having kept those filters active, then those energies will pass through those filters and there will be a transmutation, a healing process that will take place. In other words, the energetic dynamic from within is going to change. And as you recognize that it doesn't matter what happened to you. The most terrible, horrific, disastrous thing that anybody could imagine. The most dastardly deed that's ever been done. All of that is based in energy. And when we can bring those energetic dynamics that are based in pain and stored within us into the presence of love, when we can collapse the cognitive mind and bring love into the presence of those parts of the mind, that's when healing occurs. And sometimes it's experienced as nothing more than physiological trauma. If the energy was stored in the lung, the liver, the heart, the brain, whatever, then one will go through pain and trauma and turmoil in that tissue as that energy clears out. They'll come to a sensory awareness of the energy that was stored there. And if they ignore the normal inclination that's been trained into us, and that is while you hold your breath and you do your best not to feel that, if they breathe, pardon me, keep presencing love and let that energy move through them, then healing occurs. And it's not necessary to become aware of every piece of trash. And it can be helpful when it does, but not a requirement in any way, shape, or form. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Tim? Anything to add for her question?
Well, just to agree that, you know, one of the biggest things I deal with people is they think in order to go into therapy or have any use in therapy, they have to go through step by step every childhood trauma. And that's the idea behind the old psychoanalytic process and psychoanalysis, where people would go in two or three times a week and lay on the couch and stare at the ceiling and free associate and report their dreams. That, I believe, is at the very least one of the longest and least efficient ways to resolve issues. And I really like the way Way of Mastery talks about this and says, your very life, your day-to-day life, as it comes to you each moment in the day, is the most perfect ashram you could ever be in. Day-to-day life, being aware in the moment with the tools, will bring to you exactly what you need to heal within yourself. And Gaia Finley says, everyday lessons that come to me, everyday events that come to me that I don't want, every one of them has a lesson for me about what is inside me that I was not aware of until this event happened that is less than love that needs to heal. So if I can use the tools in the moment for whatever is going on, if it leads to something in the past that also needs to be dismantled, wonderful. But it's based on what's up for me in the moment. That's what I would add.
And if we circle that back to one of the ideas we started out with today, and that is that the mind does not record reality, it structures reality. And so to recognize that if there's an energy in me based in some sort of rage or guilt or grief or fear, out of that energy, or we could call it paintbrush in this context, out of that paintbrush, I paint a picture on the inside of my eyeballs that I think is about you, and you're the cause of my pain. Because when I lay my, what I think I'm doing is laying my eyes on you, what I'm really doing is, if you happen to be the person that resonates my pain, then I now have, if I have no awareness of how the game works, I now have a paintbrush inside of my hands on the inside of my eyeballs, and I paint pictures of you with it, out of my trauma and pain, and I'm sure that you're the cause of my pain, because I don't want to experience what's going on in my physiology directly. I create an indirect experience of it by putting it into my brain's image of you. But the problem with that whole process is when I put it into my brain's image of you, I'm still the one experiencing the pain. And I'm experiencing the pain because I'm using an internal paintbrush that's made of energy that never belonged within me. And when I'm painting pictures that are made out of energies that don't belong in me, then whoever I turn my eyes toward with that picture painted out of that energy, I spray that energy all over that person. And of course, when I spray that acid on them, they respond to me with an acidic tone or an acidic attitude. But when I take responsibility and I apply the tool of forgiveness, and again, very much, it ties right into, check out that Stanford stuff on awe, it ties right into that. I become more compassionate. An energetic space opens in me. I become healthier. I become more psychologically stable because I've cleaned up the part of my mind that I was using to paint a picture of you as being the bad guy in my life. And so when I make that shift into compassion and love, and I paint the picture on the inside of my eyeballs of you out of compassion and love, all of a sudden, I'm spraying a totally different energy. And I'm talking about a literal energy here. I'm spraying a different energy on you. Which environment do you suppose I'm going to get a more positive response from with people I'm interacting with? The person I'm spraying acid on or the person I'm spraying love on? Yeah, people change. And they change in a fraction of a second when we start spraying a different energy. And I think this is something that's really important for us to get. That every perception we hold that we think is about any object of attention is an energy stored in our cellular structure that becomes the paintbrush for the picture on the inside of our eyeballs, for the construct that we're doing. And again, watch this interview. It's on our Facebook page, JM_RYCE. Take a look at that interview on ABC, NBC of this fellow who's doing brain games. And he talks about, you know, our reality is a construct. We make it up. We, in an interactive way with the world, out of the energy dynamics coming in from the world, and that's why it looks like it's really true about the world, because there is some of the energy coming in from the world that's mixed with what's going on inside of me, and I create pictures that I think are about out there. And it's you know, such a huge piece of understanding to have. And, you know, how many times did I teach why is this happening to me again before I started to get that? I taught it for years and years. And there are times when I've taught that workshop three times in a day. If you don't get it all the first time you sit in front of the workshop or the first week's worksheet that you do, don't be concerned about it. It's a process. You know, when you realize that we're literally changing the reality generation system at the deepest roots of our genes and the history of 1,000 generations, it's quite an interesting task to make that shift. And it's a process. Be patient with yourself. Bring more and more awe and love into the presence of yourself. You know, it's interesting in Aramaic, you are your own neighbor. The word neighbor in Aramaic means anybody that you think about. And if you think about yourself when you're in hostility or fear, you, the being, are thinking about the non-being self, and you are your own neighbor. And when you presence love for that neighbor, that is your own non-being self, your own hostility or fear-based self, then you open the space for whatever sore in your big toe, in your kneecap, in your liver, your lung, your heart, your brain, your throat, whatever body part the energy stored in, you open the space to process through that. And processing through it isn't always Dr. Feelgood. It's not fun to start to look at what you've successfully dissociated from, perhaps for decades, perhaps for generations. But, oh, to embrace that in this presence of awe and love and process through it is just the most amazing way to arrive at a true human life. And that's what we're here to support, is everyone living as a true human being, having a true human life. Anybody else, Jeannie, with a hand up or anything in the chat room? Things are quiet. Okay, well, any final thoughts, Dr. Tim? Any summation on all of that? It's you know, I every time I approach it, I just get excited one more time. You know, people say, well, Michael, hasn't this gotten old for you yet? Oh, my God, no. I sometimes feel like I'm still just scratching the surface of understanding it myself, so.
Well,
gets more exciting. Go for it, Tim.
In line with what you're talking about here, I go back to one of the first times I was introduced to your work with the 4-hour audio CD of Why Is This Happening to Me Again. And in it, you talk about how if you're going to be exposed to something new that has a lot of depth to it, you'll grasp it faster and at a deeper level if you come at it from a number of different perspectives. And in that talk, you talk about talking about research in psychology, philosophy, religion, and science, etc. So I would offer for the people on the call today that there's a book titled The Gentle Art of Blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the critical points that Michael's talking about, this being able to tune into your true nature or choose your awareness as your nature is love and choosing love over anger and fear and revenge, is talked about in that book in a number of different ways from a theoretical perspective and from a practical perspective, different stories. And one of the stories, a patient that was in my office earlier today was reminding me of, is the story of the white birds and the black birds. And I forget the cultural, ancient cultural tradition that this came from, but in this culture they taught that each of us has a wall.
702.
And in the wall we have cubby holes that will only fit black birds and cubby holes that will only fit white birds. And each of us has this. And each of us has white birds filling all of our cubby holes and black birds filling all of our cubby holes. When we interact with somebody, if we send them the white birds, it's any positive energy, any loving energy, any compassion. It leaves a space in our wall that only white birds can fit in. So if we send the white birds out, the loving thoughts, the loving energy out to someone else, if they will open their hearts and send the loving energy back to us, there's a space in their wall for our loving energy to connect with them, and there's a space in our wall for their loving energy to connect with us. But if they refuse, if they're hurt or they're angry or they're resentful and they only send blackbirds out at us, when our white birds get to their wall, there's no place for them to land, and so they don't receive the full impact of the loving energy we've sent. And our white birds return to us, and we get the benefit of the loving energy returning to us. And when their blackbirds come at us, there aren't any holes available for the blackbirds to land, and so their negative energy, the anger, the resentment, the vengeance, returns to them, and guess what? They've got holes open, and it lands on them. So this person has found that he uses this reminder of sending out the white birds multiple times a day to help him stay on track, when to catch himself when he's angry or frustrated with traffic or a computer issue or a relationship issue. And that's just one of the wonderful stories that are in that book, The Gentle Art of Blessing by Pierre Pradervand, P-R-A-D-E-R-V-A-N-D. And that's another way you, people can read that book and get another set of perspectives on the value of choosing love. That's my offering.
Yeah, and when it comes down to it, you know, that's all just simple physics. It's the law of resonance. If I send something out, then I've created a void to draw that back into me. And, you know, what am I sending out? What am I engaging in? And we're here to support the forgiveness of every blackbird in your cubby. You know, just like, let it go. Let's be done with it. I was actually breathing someone in the still point session and the intensive, and she was just in resistance and, you know, wasn't wanting to go there. And I gave her the visualization of my granddaughter, who, when we had her in the car last time, she's in the back seat, and all of a sudden she just belts out from the movie Frozen, "Let it go, let it go." And she's just singing away at the top of her lungs. And so I started to sing this to this gal who was breathing, and it just cracked that whole dynamic of holding on to trauma up for her. And she just went from being in trauma the whole time, wanting to go back. She'd done some previous breath work where, you know, the game was he was the most trauma wins, didn't understand the still point, just went into this beautiful, peaceful state and came back with a whole experience of being that she'd never had in all her life. And so it's pretty cool when we can just let it go. We're down for the last few seconds, so we'll say thank you all for being with us. Join us tomorrow. We did get a caller there right in the middle of your story, Dr. Tim, but it was a little late to catch them. So maybe whoever it is, I think it was 702, could call us early in the show tomorrow. We'd be delighted to have the conversation with you. bring a stranger to the show tomorrow. Have the best year yet of your eternal life and blessings. Bye-bye.